Welcome to Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Good morning, Father.
Good morning, Teresa.
It's a great day, and ready to talk about church history today. Those of you who have asked or requested Father's chronology can use that today as we follow along. And last week we discussed Henry VIII, and where are we today?
Right. Well, we're going to take a little look at Edward VI and then get right into Mary I, the return of Catholicism to England. Mm-hmm. And then as we have time, we'll talk a little bit then about Elizabeth, the return of Protestantism to England after Catholicism, after Protestantism.
Right.
And also, kind of confusing, but flows one after the other. I think this is our 14th episode.
I think so. Yeah, that's right. This is number 14.
Moving right along.
We are.
Well, after Henry VIII died in 1547, he was succeeded by his son.
Mm-hmm.
However, a youth and a very sickly one at that, only 10 years old, lives another 6 years. And basically, the regency is conducted by a group of noblemen who, this council of regents, who find themselves pretty evenly split between those who have pro-Protestant leanings and those who have pro-Catholic leanings.
Okay.
Remember that they're still referring to the Church of England as the Church in England at this point. So they haven't gotten that sense that they're not Catholic anymore. And so they do a number of things in the process. First of all, they're going to try to spend a lot of time in bringing Scotland into union with England. That's going to be a real concern of theirs. Then the whole question of Protestantism itself, what flavor Protestant, I think that's what we left off last time, what flavor are we going to be? Are we going to be Lutheran? That smells a little too German. Zwingliite? That's a little too Swiss. Calvinist? That might be too radical. Anabaptist? Oh, no, that's definitely too radical. What about Unitarian? Nah, that's weird. So they don't know exactly what kind. If they're going to be Protestant, they have. And one of the things I think this shows us already is the splintering of the tangential movements away from the center of the church. It just begins to splinter out. And so even as early then as the 1550s, you have a whole variety of possible Protestant choices.
I know that you had said that Luther was concerned about that in the beginning. Are there others that in the Protestant movement that express a concern about that?
Yes. Unfortunately for them, what happened was when they would get together, they'd say, we really ought to be unified. Come on over to my side. You have these colloquies that take place from time to time. Mainly in Germany, and there'll be attempts to come to common understandings, and it's just impossible because there's no central authority.
Mm-hmm.
No one speaks as a magisterium, as a teaching authority, and as a result, it's similar to having a whole bunch of professors of theology get together, and they're just going to disagree on things, and that's exactly what comes of it.
Were there some who may have come back to the church then because of that? Do you know?
I couldn't name a name,
okay,
to tell you the truth.
Okay.
There will be some deathbed conversions,
but
Thomas Cromwell being the one that's most prominent in my mind.
Right.
But I don't, I couldn't name anybody offhand that would give up in a sense and say, wait a minute, we went in the wrong direction.
Okay.
Yeah. Although, that's prominent people. There'll be masses of people that will reconvert, particularly like when the Jesuits return to Germany, to Bohemia. Then you'll have large movements of people back into the Catholic Church. After the Council of Trent, you'll see a whole new revival taking place.
Okay.
So there you will have a lot. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I think probably the one thing that Edward is known for, if anything, is for the Book of Common Prayer. And here it's published in 1549. It's the work of Thomas Cranmer, and it has come out in other editions since then. Here you have a pretty standard English prayer book. Later on, they'll have a second edition that will be influenced by Martin Bucer. From the University of Strasbourg. He is also a protesting theologian, former, I believe, Dominican, and travels a lot all over Europe, spreading the word and spending quite a bit of time in England. And so ultimately the second edition will have more of a Luther and Calvin influence in it. The first edition is not so much. It equivocates on the Eucharist in the first edition, but in the second edition it becomes much, much more Protestant.
Okay.
Well, ultimately, Edward dies in 1553. And as they look around to see who could or would or should succeed him, the first choice is his oldest sister, half-sister, who, of course, is Mary Tudor, mm-hmm. the daughter of Catherine of Aragon. And so she's invited then to come back to England. She's in England. She's invited then to become the Queen of England. And she's very popular. This is another thing that we don't hear a lot about, but she was a very popular person, and the common people in particular had great sympathies for her, and also a love and sympathy for her mother, Catherine of Aragon, a Spanish, a woman. But remember that we have done a revision of and a cleaning up of Henry VIII. Henry VIII, when he died, was not a popular king. He was despised as a tyrant and a brute and a murderer. And so the victims of his rampages, like, for instance, Mary and her mother Catherine, were among the common people much, much more highly regarded.
Okay.
And, of course, all the movies and everything that we've had since then have been given the lie to all of that. In fact, quite honestly, as you look at the reign of Mary, and if you look at the reign of Queen Elizabeth, who follows after her, it's a study in almost cartoon imaging. On the one hand, you have Bloody Mary, mm-hmm. and on the other hand, Good Queen Bess.
Uh-huh,
you know,
right.
it almost sounds like some kind of a no time limit, single fall, no holds barred women's wrestling federation match or something. But it just goes to show you the incredible propaganda that's happened mm-hmm. As a result. In fact, there's a movie that just came out a couple years ago called Elizabeth.
Yeah,
it's an interesting film. A number of people had encouraged me to see it, and I did. The best thing about the film is the music.
Yeah.
It's got beautiful music. The sets are very nice and all. But I think that when it comes to the characters, they really oversimplify things. William Cecil, who we'll see a little bit later on, is given the... So you get the impression that he's some kind of a turtle, you know, kind of a guy. He just goes around doing the bidding of the queen and all that. He's a lot more active than that. Mary herself is seen as a sinister, disturbed woman who is fanatically Catholic and all. That is a really incredible, poor portrayal of who this woman really was. But anyway, you got to be careful when you watch films, historical
right.
films, to see whether there's any history to them at all.
Right.
Know. Well, anyhow, let's take a look at Mary, Mary Tudor. She is the eldest sister of Edward VI, and so she's invited to come back. She's the daughter of Henry VIII, therefore of the bloodline, and Catherine of Aragon, the first wife of Henry VIII.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time of the divorce, she was 11 years old.
Okay.
This struck her very much. She was put aside basically under house arrest for the next 10 years.
Wow.
And at the age of 21, her mother died. And with that, royal officials arrived and forced her to sign a document that said that her mother was not actually legally or sacramentally married to her father. So it was either that or die,
mm-hmm.
or who knows what they would have done with her. But she had to sign this. And basically it was a recognition that she was a bastard.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and she had no alternative. She had to sign this. Well, now at the age of 37, she becomes the Queen mm-hmm. of England. How things happen. She has aged way beyond her years. She is a very devout Catholic, had not married. She probably would have spent her whole life in prayer.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been her fate in life, and she, I think, probably accepted that and the humiliation of all this. Now all of a sudden she's raised to this great honor, but that doesn't mean that everybody was excited about it. She had lots of enemies,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them gathered around the Duke of Northumberland, a man by the name of John Dudley, who tried to thwart the succession.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you have most of the people demanding a Tudor, and then he is trying to thwart this from happening. In the area called East Anglia, there was a revolt, and he succeeded in getting the people to rise up against, at least a number of people to rise up against Queen Mary. And he had another woman that he wanted to be queen instead. This was the Lady Jane Grey. She's 16 years old,
yeah.
You know, and she was a figurehead, and he was mm-hmm. using her. And in the end, the revolt was put down. Parliament backed Mary and even passed a bill to give her the money in order to raise an army to put down Dudley's revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And when the revolt was crushed, then Dudley was executed as a traitor. And Lady Jane Grey was sent to the Tower and looked forward to execution also. But Mary forgave her, saying that as a 16-year-old youth, she didn't know what she was doing,
mm-hmm.
and gave her a second chance. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is that things would be difficult for Mary right from the very beginning. And part of the problem was that besides being the Queen of England, one of her titles was the supreme head of the Church of the supreme head of the Church after God.
Okay.
Now, of course, there's a problem there because mm-hmm. as a devout Catholic, she realized that she was not the supreme mm-hmm. head of the Church after God, but rather that the Holy Father in Rome was.
Mm-hmm.
And so she would have to, as the head of the Church in England, have to find a way to get out of that title.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a kind of an interesting dilemma to be in. What she does, and this becomes very important again for parliamentary history, is she goes to Parliament.
Okay.
Because she recognizes that only Parliament can abjure what Parliament had passed. So the next thing then is to persuade Parliament to undo the title. And so she goes back to do that. While this is happening, a good number of pro-Protestant English families bolt England and take off for parts of Europe. Particularly a good number, interestingly enough, go to Heidelberg. This is a Protestant hotbed. The Elector of the Palatinate is a very strong supporter. And so they found comfort there in Heidelberg, Strasbourg, Frankfurt, a couple other German cities. And they received aid then and sustenance in that area, and so she has to find herself then working with Parliament in order to overturn all of this. At the same time, she is also involved in foreign affairs because she is, after all, a tutor who makes her half Habsburg,
mm-hmm.
and you can't get away from the Habsburgs; they're mm-hmm. all over the place. And so her cousin Charles V. is going to be drawing her into alliances and all. This begins to cause her stock to go down in the eyes of the English people,
okay.
because more and more England is being seen as part of the Habsburg realm,
uh-huh.
which England never wants. You know, they're always very independent, and so there's some real problems with this. But nonetheless, in 1553, Parliament gave Mary what she needed in order to restore what they refer to as the old religion. So that takes place in 1554. They support her with even more money as a result of yet a second revolt against her. This revolt was being led by Sir Thomas Wyatt, and it's called the Wyatt Rebellion. And again, it's crushed. Wyatt is executed, and rounded up among all the other ringleaders of this revolution is none other than Lady Jane Grey. Some people can't get enough. And this time around, she's executed also. Yeah. Well, Mary marries a second cousin of hers, King Philip II of Spain. He is the son of Charles I. Mm-hmm. And Charles abdicates his throne in 1555. Later on, we'll take a look at the life of this man. It's absolutely incredible. But in October of 1555, after a brief but very ugly war in Germany, Charles basically says, I've had it. I don't need this anymore. I'm out of here. And went and lived the remainder of his life in a monastery. And he gave over the German part of the Habsburg realm to his brother, mm-hmm. Ferdinand, who then was in charge of that. And then the Spanish part he hands over to Philip, Philip II, who now is the husband of Mary. And
England.
Yes, of England. However, because of pressing concerns back in the Spanish realm, he leaves England shortly after the wedding, and the two of them never saw each other again.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Isn't that something?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He was involved in wars and all this kind of stuff. Of course, being involved with wars, one would expect that his wife would then come in on her husband's side, which she did. England then became an ally to the Spanish Habsburgs. The war did not go too terribly well for Philip. And in the midst of all of this, the French, being on the other side, of course, saw an opportunity, and they seized the port of Calais, which was the last piece of property owned by the English in France.
Okay.
You remember, you go back several hundred years, the Hundred Years' War. Mm-hmm. France at one time was about a quarter of it, a third of it, was occupied by English, mm-hmm. Who had traced their ancestry back to William of Normandy. Well, now this is the last piece of English property in France, and they take it. And once again, Mary is blamed for this. And so once again, her stock sort of goes down a little bit. What she is doing at this time, too, is she is now that she's reintroduced the Catholic Church back to England, now that the English once again recognize the Pope as the head of the Church in England after God, then the other side of this is that not everyone had ran off to Europe to hide from this Catholic queen, and some of them were still fomenting Protestant change. Some of them were dragging their feet in implementing the new Catholic decrees, and so she began then a campaign to root out the Protestants within England.
Okay.
This eventually will lead to the execution of 275 people. Okay. Now, among those, in fact, one of the earliest ones to be executed will be Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury. 275. Keep that number in mind.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, because we have to keep in perspective the numbers. It's actually a very small number in comparison to what's going on in other countries. But that 275 is going to be the grist in the mill of a propagandist by the name of John Fox. It's F-O-X-E. He is going to write a book in 1563 called Acts and Monuments, in which he's going to, it's a martyrology for Protestants during the reign of Bloody Mary.
Mm-hmm.
This is the propaganda piece that's going to give the rise to the notion of her being this sinister force. Goes into all kinds of lurid and made up details.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Mary herself does not live terribly long. She dies in November of 1558.
Oh, okay.
And she dies the very same day that her chief minister and confidant dies. It's just a real strange coincidence of history. But this is Cardinal Reginald Pole. Cardinal Pole is an absolutely incredible human being, a great churchman. He had left England during the reign of Henry VIII and was studying in Rome at the time of the divorce. And he's just a young priest. Henry writes to Father Pole and says, I'd like your opinion concerning my divorce with Catherine of Aragon. Paul takes some time out, does some research, and writes, I believe, a 45-page letter back to the king explaining why it was illegitimate for him to divorce his wife. Just a really incredible character. Eventually becomes a bishop, stays in Rome, obviously doesn't go back to England, stays in Rome. Eventually becomes a bishop, is named a cardinal, and will be one of the three governor cardinals at the Council of Trent.
Okay.
So he has a tremendous influence. At one of the conclaves, he came within one vote of being elected the next pope.
Wow.
Isn't that something?
Yeah,
it was. He really is an incredible fellow. And so then, brilliant, well-educated, a true Renaissance man, once again a Christian humanist. And Mary brings him back to England then in order to advise her and to reestablish the Catholic Church in England, which they were well underway. Then, of course, at the end, both of them dying at the same time.
Hmm.
And what you end up with then is this very sad legacy of Mary as being some kind of a gloomy bigot, you know, this bloody Mary. You hear people talk about this being the greatest spillage of blood in all of English history, not by a long shot. Horrors at burning heretics, but not heretics, Bible Christians operating at the hands of the devil, all these sorts of things. At the same time, just look at numbers. What did we say? 275.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's a sad thing that happened.
Yeah.
It is. Up north, and now in Calvinist Scotland, okay,
uh-huh.
Something along the lines of 8,000 women were put to death, burned to death for being witches. You know?
Wow.
When you consider that's 1% of the population of Scotland at the time, that is a bloodbath.
Yes, definitely.
Look at what's going on in France, in Germany, in many, many countries. Spain has its own Inquisition, although we'll talk a little bit about that later on, because Philip Kamen, a wonderful historian of this period, shows through using the archives, the Spanish archives of the Inquisition, shows that in fact, once again, it's the result of the black legend, this attack on, and in fact, it's a much smaller number than what. But I think if we use as a benchmark what happened in Scotland, 8,000 people over less than 50 years, and then say, okay, can anyone match that? The fact of the matter is that nobody can match that. And, of course, don't we have our own sordid history here in Massachusetts?
Right.
You know, with the burning of witches and all this, and some of the other ugly things that take place up in New England.
Right.
And Hutchinson and people like that. So this is a rough period of history. That's all there is to it.
Do we know how Mary died? There's no suspect of either of them being put to death, is there?
No, there isn't. No, poisoning or something like that. No.
Yeah.
No, there's no smoking gun, and I don't recall anyone ever even questioning it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, what do you have now? You've got the daughter of Anne Boleyn.
Mm.
You know, Elizabeth, and Elizabeth is a big question mark. Quite honestly, nobody knows exactly where she's going to come down on things, because honestly, she never had a religious education from either side.
Okay.
The people who cared for her after the death of her mother
mm-hmm.
simply did not give her any religious instruction. It was just too dangerous. And so many Protestants just assumed that she would be Protestant. There was this great flood of emigres coming back to England after the death of Mary. And so in 1559... one of the first things she does is she then moves toward the restoration of the Act of Supremacy and the Act of Uniformity. And how does she do this? She goes to Parliament, because only Parliament can abjure what Parliament had previously abjured, what Parliament had passed previously to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see this tradition beginning to build up. She's 25 years old at the time of her ascension. She also is not married. She has lived a very careful life. unlike Mary, quite honestly, while Mary was living in house arrest, she also made arrangements that she celebrated Mass. She had a priest come in every day and celebrate Mass throughout the reign of her dad and of her stepbrother. She could get away with that because, first of all, it was a private Mass, mm-hmm. And then secondly, because she was, after all, of royal blood. Mm-hmm. But she was clearly Catholic. With Elizabeth, as they say, they didn't know where she would be in all of this. She was incredibly lucky because at the time that she ascended to the throne, right around that same time, the Germany had just had its first religious war, and we can see Charles retired. The Habsburgs were now split into two parts. Ferdinand was much more concerned of what was happening over in Germany. He wasn't going to get involved in stuff. And then also with the Turks, who were beating on his doorstep. Philip, the former wife, or the husband of Queen Mary, is one of the great procrastinators of history.
Okay.
He spent most of his time in the Escorial, in this huge central building, government building outside of Madrid, up above Madrid. And he had a lot of problems, too, going on. First of all, he had the whole Western Hemisphere, practically the whole Western Hemisphere, to take care of. Besides that, other explorations, besides that, the Turks are running across the Mediterranean. He is the only one that's going to do anything about it. Well, later on we'll talk about the Battle of Lepanto and how that came about. So he's got all of these problems going on. He's got the problems in the Netherlands going on, and because that's part of the Spanish Habsburgs, Spanish Netherlands. And so he has all of those things, and then besides that, he just takes forever to make a decision. So Elizabeth doesn't have anything to worry about from the Habsburgs. At the same time, she has nothing to worry about from the French, because the French have just gone into a religious civil war that will go on for years. So, you know, she's very fortunate, mm-hmm. you know. And so she's got that breather. At the same time, she begins moving very quietly but also very deliberatively in England. Anyone around the court could pick up that this was not going to be a Catholic queen. First of all, right after the burial of Mary I, she calls in Bishop John White. Bishop White had delivered the eulogy at the funeral of Queen Mary, and during that eulogy, he mentioned that she was a good Catholic and a fine woman, and he also mentioned that as monarch that she had delivered England from heresy. And Elizabeth chided him for that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess in a sense she's sort of right, because it was more a question of schism than heresy, at least at that point. So, but that's not what she was getting at.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, after that, at Christmas Day, the first Christmas of her as queen, it became pretty obvious where things were heading. She called in the bishop who would be celebrating Christmas Mass for the royal family, Bishop Oglethorpe, and told him that at the moment of consecration, he was not to elevate the host. He was not to elevate the host. Well,
okay. And what was his response?
He said yes, he would not elevate the host. She didn't even stay around to see. She left right after the gospel, and I guess started the trend of leaving late and or coming late and leaving early at Mass. You know, but yeah, she left right after the gospel, and so this was pretty clear. She was giving some indications.
Mm-hmm.
Right after this, you have a whole barrage of proclamations and edicts and directives that begin coming out, telling bishops how to do this, that, and the other, telling priests how to do this, that, and the other, what's allowed, what's not allowed. And throughout 1559, it became pretty obvious that the church in England was not going to be the good old religion of former days.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And yet, the heart of England still remained Catholic. The common people still had a great devotion. Remember by now that the monasteries had been suppressed.
Right.
The bishops had been pretty much beaten up. They were a bunch of lapdogs. You had one thing after another, but still the people remained pretty solidly Catholic. It's Parliament that has to be turned first. See, if they can get Parliament on their side, then people begin looking upon the changes as being legitimate. And this is going to be done mainly by the chief aide and advisor to Queen Elizabeth. This is Sir William Cecil.
Okay.
Ultimately, Parliament will forbid the priests of England to say Mass. Mass will be suppressed. There are about 8,000 priests in England at the time, and the vast majority of them went along with this. The bishops, on the other hand, stood up against it. Finally, they found their backbone, and when Elizabeth sent them an oath. Of loyalty to the Act of Uniformity, they all refused to sign it. And they were all dismissed.
Okay.
All the bishops of England were basically dismissed, with the exception of one bishop. This was Bishop Anthony Kitchen, who was an interesting old codger. He's 90 years old. And all the others were dismissed. Kitchen refused to sign this oath also. But he was forgiven because he told the queen that although he would not sign the oath, that he would do everything he could for her. Anyhow, the long and short of this is that that without any bishops, she had a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem was that she had to get herself a new Archbishop of Canterbury. And her choice on this was a professor, actually a former president rector of one of the colleges at Oxford, Corpus Christi College. His name was Matthew Parker. Dr. Parker was a brilliant man, had studied abroad, and did not want to be Archbishop of Canterbury. The one thing that this guy had a tremendous devotion to was his own neck. He did everything he could to avoid anyone knowing who he was. He is one of the few bishops who had been pro-Protestant who did not flee under the reign of Mary the First. So he's not one of the 275 who was executed. He's not one of those who left England for Heidelberg, Strasbourg, Frankfurt, wherever. Because he was so insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the way
he wanted to say.
Sure. He had no idea whether Elizabeth was going to be around a long time or not, or whether she'd change her mind or whatever. So he really tried to back out of all of this. What happened was she strong-armed the canons of Canterbury.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were 12 canons. These are priests of high order, and they had the right of election, and so they would elect then the next Archbishop of Canterbury, and she told him that she wanted this guy elected. It turned out that 7 of the 12 were sick that day.
Oh, really?
Yes. Only 6 showed up. They voted the way the queen wanted, and so with a minority vote, he then is elected as Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, there's a little problem here, and the problem is one of consecration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be consecrated if you're a bishop.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, you can only be consecrated by other bishops. And this is a real problem. Traditionally, in England, it takes at least 4 bishops to consecrate a new bishop.
Okay.
Yeah. And, of course, she didn't have them.
Kitchen.
Yeah, and so what happens ultimately is that she will find 2 bishops among the bishops who had been consecrated during the reign of Henry VIII or prior. In other words, they're legitimate and valid bishops. She will get 2 of them. She could only, out of the whole group, she could only get 2 of them, and she coerced them to come. And then she chose 2 other bishops who had been made bishops at the time of Edward VI. But there's a problem here. And the problem is that they were not consecrated by valid bishops. So they're not valid bishops. Mm-hmm. So the best she could do was a mix of four bishops, two of them validly consecrated and two of them invalidly consecrated. And with that, you have then the consecration of Dr. Matthew Parker as the Archbishop of Canterbury. And with that, of course, he can then begin making bishops also. There's a real problem in all of this because the rite of consecration begins. If you ever go to a bishop's consecration, listen to the words, "Has the apostolic mandate been received?" The response is, "Yes, it has." The response to that is, "Let it be read." And with that, the apostolic mandate from Rome, from the Pope, then orders the consecration to take place. Mm-hmm. Okay. Obviously, there was no apostolic mandate for this. And so, as a result, the consecration itself is, if you look at things from the radial point of view, if you look at things from the Rome center part of view, this is a sacrilege, not a consecration that takes place. Well, ultimately, what you have then is now a schismatic church. There's no doubt about it. It's clearly schismatic. And so the question is, well, it's going to be heretical also. Depends on how they develop their theology. But Elizabeth is absolutely happy with what she has because she has a quote-unquote reformed church with bishops. Mm-hmm. You know, and clearly, with the development that takes place, which she has already started and what develops afterwards, the Anglican Church, we can now call this the Church of England, is clearly a Protestant church. Interestingly enough, only 5% of the clergy of England resigned their positions. Wow. 95% accepted this this sham. The House of Lords will be a hotbed of Catholic sentiment, and that'll remain for some time. They're hard to touch. These are very prominent, powerful people. Mm-hmm. They continue to keep alive their Catholicism within their own households. And this, interestingly enough, has a lot to do with the development of the unique nature of English Catholicism, which comes over to this country, to the United States, and really implants in Maryland and the East Coast a very private Catholicism. That's not typical. Typically, Catholics tend to be pretty in-the-streets kind of people, you know, Corpus Christi processions, mm-hmm. big things like that, mm-hmm. you know. The English form of Catholicism tends to be much more private. It's one of those things that it's not polite to talk about religion, you know. And I think a lot of that really comes from this era.
Right.
You know, quite honestly, to be public meant to be dead.
Right.
You know, so that's how they do this. Nonetheless, England now is governed, religiously, is governed by what is referred to as the 39 Articles. And these are 39 statements that have strong Lutheran tenets to them and at the same time attack what they refer to as Romish errors. Elizabeth then spends the remainder of her time as queen, and it's a long reign, the remainder of her time isolating the two C's. C's for Calvinists, because she doesn't want her church to be too Protestant. Yeah. And if she went in that direction, you know, Calvinism is really religiously a democratic movement. And so she didn't want that. She wanted her bishops. And then at the same time, the other C being Catholic. So she moves between the two, and she establishes what is referred to among English Anglicans as the via media, the middle way. And a lot of Englishmen become very enthusiastic over this. That's all fine and good for England. Mm-hmm. But she also has two other Celtic pots that are boiling over, one to the north and one to the west. And so let's go ahead and start taking a look at both of those because she plays a role in both of them.
Okay.
The one is going to be in Scotland, the other one in Ireland. Okay. And in Scotland, you have a very interesting situation. Everything's in flux, everything's in play. By this time, John Knox has already come back from school in Geneva. Mm-hmm. He's all full of wonderful Calvinist ideas and is trying to move the church. Ultimately, he will be the founder of the church, the Calvinist church in Scotland, which is called the Presbyterian Church.
Okay.
And so he's going to be moving in that direction. Basically, Scotland is broken into two factions, Catholic and Calvinist, and the two of them are vying back and forth. The Calvinists, of course, are led by John Knox, who from time to time is away in Europe because he's exiled. In fact, on one point he was captured and then put onto, a galley. He was a galley slave for a number of years until he was finally freed after he'd served his sentence, came back and started all over again. The Catholic side was ill-served by the Queen, Mary Stuart, Mary Queen of Scots. And there's a movie about her also. And I think there was a book written a number of years ago, a very popular biography. And they're true. She was a very attractive woman. She was very passionate, and she was very rash. She was married to a fine young man, but she had too much love for one person and spread it out and all about, and everybody knew it. She had fallen in love with a court musician, among others, who was one night visited by Mary's husband and some of his friends and was hacked to death. As a warning to Mary to be more devoted to her family, you know. But it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Her husband, Lord Derby, ended up with a bad case of smallpox. Mm-hmm. Himself had to be moved out of the castle and was put in a small house near the castle, where he would be able to continue on, but smallpox was a death sentence at the time. Interestingly enough, late one night, the house blew up.
Okay.
His house blew up. He was killed. Investigators found that he did not die in the explosion, but had died previous to the explosion, that he had been strangled to death before the house was blown up. So obviously, the blowing up of the house was a way
cover up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now, who would do this to a man who has a death sentence of smallpox anyway? You know, it's somebody who wants to see him dead quickly, mm-hmm, for some reason. Now, what could that reason possibly be, Mary?
Mm-hmm.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened. They never found the guilty party, but all the fingers were pointing and all the evidence was pointing to the Earl of Bothwell, who happened to marry the widow 3 months after the death of her husband.
Wow.
This did not go over well.
No.
Scotland fell apart into civil war. Now, it wouldn't take much for Scotland to fall apart anyway, because they're blessed with the Celtic curse of infighting. As you know, between Scotland and Ireland, you look and you go, come on, get your act together. They were constantly fighting tribe against tribe, you know, clan against clan, and so this is exactly what happens. Scotland becomes so unstable for Mary Stuart to stay that she fled. Mm-hmm. And she flees to England, mm-hmm, for safety, right into the arms and jail of Elizabeth I.
Mm-hmm.
So there she is. Now she's locked up in England. Things are not looking good. There are a number of attempts and plots on the part of Catholics, both Scottish Catholics and English Catholics, to free her, mm-hmm, and help her to get to France or someplace to get out of town.
To get out of the jail.
To get out of jail for, mm-hmm, sure. At the same time, you also have a number of Jesuits who are slipping back into England, working undercover, Because, quite honestly, you couldn't trust the secular clergy of England anymore. 95% of them had buckled under, and now were acting as Anglicans. And so the Jesuits were given the special assignment of going into England and to continue the life of English Catholicism, preaching the gospel, converting people. In fact, there's even special, you know, you go to these castles and they have special doors that don't look like doors that lead into little chambers. They're called priest doors. And this is where the Jesuits would be hidden if the house were visited upon.
Oh, wow.
You know. There's an old English thing that, you know, your home is your castle, that inviolability of private property. You cannot have your house seized or searched. Well, these are being violated now. Warrants are quickly being released in order to hunt up possible Catholics, and especially Jesuit priests. And the most famous of which, of course, is Edmund Campion. This suppression, this persecution of Jesuits, and I'll tell you, when these guys were captured, they were tortured to death. The most hideous ways they would be killed. This is one aspect of the movie, Elizabeth, that was quite graphic and quite true. They showed the torture of one of the Jesuits that had been captured. It also sets up an animosity between the Jesuits and Queen Elizabeth that went on for centuries. We have a couple minutes. I have a wonderful story that I heard when I was a graduate student at St. Louis U. I don't know who the priest was, but the story goes that many years ago, that there was a convent of sisters here in St. Louis who wanted to have a day of recollection, and they had made arrangements with a Jesuit from St. Louis University to come and give them, lead them through a day of recollection. And the priest, the younger priest, had double booked himself, and at the last minute he realized it, and he was trying to find a substitute, and he couldn't find anyone except for this elderly retired Jesuit. And he prevailed on him to go out and give the day of recollection to the sisters. Well, he was an historian, a Jesuit historian, and he went out. And the story goes that he spent the whole day of recollection talking about the Jesuits and the history of the Jesuits, and particularly the martyrs in England, the Jesuit martyrs in England. And at one point, he got really animated, and he says to the sisters, he says, "And sisters, do you know what they call this woman, this Queen Elizabeth of England? Do you know what they call her? They call her the Virgin Queen." And all of a sudden he goes, "She was no more a virgin than you or me." Needless to say, he wasn't invited back. His story might be apocryphal, but it's a good one.
Oh my.
Well, ultimately Elizabeth will kill over 200 priests and Catholic nobles who were trying to practice their faith. 200. So she's coming pretty darn close to her half-sister in that. There's no black legend about Elizabeth, except among elderly Jesuits. In 1587, then, it is just too hot to have Mary, Queen of Scots, around. And so she herself is executed. This is regicide. Killing, you know, kings and queens, killing kings and queens is something you just don't see. And doing this really caught the attention of an awful lot of people. You know. Well, so much for Scotland.
Right.
I don't know that we have time. Do we have time to talk a little bit about Ireland?
We have about 10 minutes.
Okay, well, let's just jump into Ireland. Ireland has got the Celtic problem, you know, feuding, fighting amongst themselves. Okay, they could definitely be, a powerhouse, but, you know, did you ever hear the joke about the Irishman walking down the street and there's a big brawl going on and he runs up over to this fight and he goes, "Is this a private fight or can anyone get in?"
Right. Yeah.
Well, there's an awful lot to that.
Right, exactly.
And, of course, as a result of that, Ireland has always been plagued with foreigners coming in, and especially the English. The English have been interested in Ireland way before Elizabeth, way before Elizabeth. There is, in fact, the whole eastern part of Ireland is dominated by a group of Englishmen that had been living in Ireland for so many generations. They're simply known as the Old English. Think of Ireland as a ball, okay? And you can divide Ireland in half, east and west, really by the Shannon River. Almost runs directly east and runs north and south, right through the center of Ireland. To the east of the Shannon River is a beautiful, lush country with lots of meadows and some forest land, wonderful peat bogs, very rich and agrarian, lots of cattle and sheep and all. West of the Shannon River, it's rough. This is a land that is dominated by the North Atlantic winds. It rains a lot. It's rugged. In fact, there's a whole section of it called the Barrens, and with good name for it. Yeah. In the south, you have some beautiful area. The sort of the agriculture continues on down in the south with some wonderful ports, Cork, Kinsale, some of the others. Up north, very, very rugged over on the west side, the northwest side, Donegal. Over on the east side, once again, some very fine ports, flatlands. This, of course, now is today, it's Belfast in Northern Ireland. So think of Ireland in those senses. And then think that the whole eastern half, the rich half of Ireland, is dominated by these old English families that have been around, some of them, since the Middle Ages.
Okay.
You know, the rest of Ireland is Celtic. Now remember that the English are Anglo-Saxon, the Germanic peoples. The rest of Ireland is Celtic. It's all part of that huge empire that predated the Romans, that stretched from Ireland all the way to present-day Turkey. You know, there are only little tiny pockets of it left. Ireland, Scotland, Wales, a little piece of Spain is still Celtic. A little tiny part of France, the peninsula of Brittany, is still Celtic. And in Ireland, the Celtic Irish were very poor. They basically lived on oats, on milk and butter, what they could get from their little bit of cattle or their little bit of goats and sheep that they had, and then watercress and herbs. That's basically what they lived on. The religion had been there, of course, in St. Patrick. It was part and parcel. The Irish was to be Catholic. To be Catholic was to be Irish. And in Ireland, it was just that's the way it was. Families had their own priests. It was hereditary, you know, that passed down. And then really you had a lot of reformation that took place in the late Middle Ages with the introduction of the Franciscans. Mm-hmm. When the Franciscans came to Ireland, they really brought Ireland back to the center of the church. Ireland had been pretty much on its own throughout much of the Middle Ages. The High Middle Ages, you have the building of Irish Franciscan monasteries, and now a strong Irish Catholic center. And you know, the Irish, of course, I think there was a book that said the Irish saved Christianity. Really, really did. It was a real powerhouse for vocations for these many centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just think of the dilemma of the English Irishman when their mother country, their land of their ancestries, then went over to Protestantism.
Right.
This is the old English. I feel more sorry for them than anybody because they were out by themselves. They were totally isolated. They no longer could look back to England, and at the same time, they had never assimilated with the Irish that lived in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they were really caught in a really tough tough situation. You know? And this is the group that's going to feel the wrath of Elizabeth, the first and the most. They are still very loyal to Rome. And now what happens is that, you know, they send their sons back to England to university. And so when they send them back to schools like Oxford and Cambridge, and the kids are now coming back home and they're questioning the church and they're spouting out all this Protestant stuff, right away they sent the transcripts off to continental schools. And so now you have more Irish, young Irishmen studying over in France and Rome. In other parts of Europe,
okay.
which is going to bring them away from England all the more. So I think, you know, it would be best for us just to stop at this point and then develop this a little bit more next time around and look at the whole dilemma of the Irish Catholics in dominated by English Protestants.
All right.
Good.
Well, thank you so much, Father. Great show. And will you close with prayer for us today?
Sure. Okay. Let us remember that we're in God's holy presence. Divine Father, as you shower your blessings upon us, as we have this radio program this week, we're in the midst of so many saints that we remember this week. St. Charles Lwanga yesterday and his martyrdom in Uganda, which gave such an impetus to the church in Uganda, which is so healthy and growing so beautifully. Tomorrow we celebrate the feast of St. Boniface, the patron whose blood brings Catholicism and feeds Catholicism in Germany. 2 days ago, Marcellinus and Peter, whose early martyrdom during the reign of Diocletian gave seed to conversions in Rome and in Italy. And so we just ask you, Lord, to continue to bless your church and make us prosper. Just in those words of the psalmist, prosper the work of our hands, O Lord. Prosper the work of our hands. We pray this in Jesus' name.
Amen. Amen.